Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. My guest this episode is Brian Till. Known Brian for a good while, followed him for a lot longer. He was one of North America's strong, truly strong young open-wheel drivers coming up the 1980s. And as someone who was a few years behind him on a similar trail, albeit as a mechanic, followed him intently, really rooted for him along the way as he came up through Atlantic, and then eventually worked his way into IndyCar in the early 90s. So he's a guy that truly I thought we were going to have in IndyCar for quite some time. While that didn't pan out in terms of a career arc in the cockpit, he has since spent decades calling those races, whether it's in the booth or on pit lane. Brian has really just become synonymous with high quality work calling motor races. Someone who you'll probably see him most frequently on the IMSA side. Before that, with the America Le Mans Series, with Grand Am. Also someone who has been in the IndyCar world too, in terms of calling races. So just someone who is phenomenally good at his job, and also someone that I've just really enjoyed knowing for, I guess, more than a decade now. Back when I worked at Speed, starting in 2006 or so, he was one of just the nicest people right off the bat who introduced himself and really welcomed me in, showed me whatever I needed, and or just been a really strong supporter. So really cool cat, someone who I've been wanting to sit down with for quite some time to do one of the My Racing Life and Career episodes. This little piece, which is fun, we actually recorded in October of 2017, so a little bit late on this one. And admittedly, although we captured this at the Monterey, it was the World Challenge California Invitational Endurance Race. He was there working as a race steward. So here it is. I hope you enjoy it. Really spent a fair amount talking about his life coming up in the world, the influences that he had, how he got into racing, and we definitely paused with an intent to do a part two to get into the IndyCar side of his world and the broadcast side of his world. But if you're a fan of Brian Till and really do enjoy what he does for a living through the broadcast world, you might find this rather interesting, because I enjoyed it. It was also fun, too, with a couple of unexpected appearances. Sports car team owner Peter Barron showed up and didn't just say hello, snuck up on Brian. I could see him coming. I thought he was just going to stick his head around and spook him. No, he planted a giant kiss on his lips. And, you know, look, I don't care who you love and whatever. I can tell you, Brian wasn't overly shocked or put off. So that might be the a third episode to get into here about the relationship between these two crazy people. And we also had our friend Romain Dumas pop in towards the end to say hello. So just a very friendly paddock there in Monterey. As I mentioned in the beginning, month of July, we have the Justice Brothers on board here at the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. We'll be back right after this. This month, the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is being supported by the Justice Brothers, whose line of additives, lubricants, and cleaners are America's brand for quality. The products are also used and proven by the world's top racing teams. So if you're interested in joining the sales and distribution team, Justice Brothers offers products for the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets. To learn more, please check out their website at justicebrothers.com. All right, so you know you can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast by subscribing on iTunes, also on Podbean, Google Play is another option, and Spotify is the latest addition where you can find our little motor racing fun fest. With all that said, let's get going with Brian Till, My Racing Life and Career Part 1, on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires.
I'm fired up now.
Well,
that just did it all.
Brian Till, we have been wanting to do a career lifetimes and origins podcast.
Oh,
or at least
God.
I have. You and Mr. Witness Relocation Program.
So we're finished with this then, because
yes,
it's career.
Done.
It took about that long.
Exactly. You and I have known each other for, I don't know, 10 years plus?
Yep.
Probably dating back to our Speed days. I, as someone who worked for far too many years on what would have been the old Mazda Road to Indy in the 80s, followed you with intent coming up that ladder system. And so I've just always appreciated your career.
When my hair was dark and your beard was too.
Yes. Actually, I didn't have a beard. That would have been pretty cool if I was 16 having a beard in high school. Anyways, I've just always enjoyed you as a person, and I know this. How's this? I get paid to be a hard-hitting motorsports journalist. I do this for my damn self, so there is something hard, but it's not hitting. Hey, try the veal, boys and girls.
And what's the best thing that we've ever done together? Because we haven't really done much, if anything, together, but Le Mans this year.
I would say Le Mans this year. I'm still riding a high on. That was so much fun.
Yeah.
And
you and Kettler together there was so much that was added to the broadcast because of that.
And
although you were in your little dark closet for a while.
But not the whole time. And you were actually the one that said, great recognition by a professional, hey, wouldn't it be better if we had everybody in the same room so we can see each other?
See each other, yeah.
So that actually helped fix that little fun thing. Let's wind the clock back just to start by getting to know a little bit about where you came from. I'm a huge believer that environment really does dictate so much of who we become.
Both good and bad.
Where did young Brian Till grow up? When? What did your parents do? What kind of world did you come into?
So Brian Till grew up and is in Texas and is still a proud Texan, even though I don't live there anymore. And I think there's just something about the state that, I don't know. I mean, it's...
What part?
Houston.
Suburbs? The hood?
The west side of town. The north side of town, then the west side of town. So I lived in three different houses growing up. My father was an attorney, and a very well-known attorney, but you gotta work your way up. So, it's really funny. Both my mom and dad, who are deceased, grew up. My dad grew up until he was 12 years old in Appleby, Texas, which
Appleby,
yeah.
I love it.
So Appleby is kind of up in East Texas near Nacogdoches, which, you're very familiar with that.
Well, unfortunately, I think a lot of folks learn that name.
Well, yeah, yeah. In not
sad,
a good way.
Sad yep. circumstances.
So Nacogdoches and Lufkin up in that area, and he moved to Houston when he was 12 years old. He and his mom and dad, he's an only child. They lived in a two-room house in Appleby. Not a two-bedroom house, a two-room house. And then they moved to Houston. His dad drove a gasoline tank truck for Shell and delivered gasoline around town. And dad was an athlete in high school and all that. And then when he got out, he went to the Navy, used his GI Bill to pay for college at the University of Houston, and then read light meters for Houston Lighting and Power for law school. So dad was...
Wow.
Peter Barron just kissed me on the lips. You know, this is great. So since Peter's standing here, I had somebody say to me last night, there's some...
He's smart enough.
Who's the crew member in the paddock? He sounds American, but I don't think he's American because he looks kind of European. But his toenails are painted. And I said, oh, no, that's Peter Barron.
Oh, yeah.
He's American. He lives in Florida. And they went, he doesn't act like American. But I said, he has a daughter. The excuse was his daughter used to paint his toenails when she was young. But that was like 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
She's got to be like 20 years old now. I think Peter has his toenails painted these
days.
Pretty. You feel sexy?
Yeah. Look, he and Ronda Rousey have that in common. You know, I mean, there's nothing wrong there. Well, great to see you, Peter. It's all good. Just a little interlude. So
anyway, my dad was a self-made guy. You know, he came from literally nothing and became one of the top 10 insurance defense attorneys in the entire country. And, but he always was the country boy from East Texas.
Wow. Yeah,
that never changed. And, you know, the legal profession was different then. He passed away in 1985, and it was still a very much good old boy, don't hit the meter and start the clock running when your client calls. And you know, it's a very different business now.
And how, obviously being raised in Texas, being a Texan, how Texan was your mindset? And I ask that in context of your father. I mean, my father is from Marianna, Arkansas. He moved to California where I was raised, born and raised, but I was raised by a Southern man. So while I am unquestionably Californian, a lot of my sensibilities, a lot of my views of the world and leanings happen to come from a Marianna, Arkansas kind of angle.
Yeah, I mean...
Just curious how much your father's influenced that kind of...
I think my father... Well, I mean, I think... in any family that stays together and raises the kids together and all that other kind of stuff, you can't help but be molded by your family. I will tell you that when I look at my dad and I look at his dad, they were two very different people. My grandfather was what you would picture, you know, as a country boy from the South being, the good and the bad, you know, the determination, the hard work and all of that, and also some of the not so highlighted and the good side of what the South was back then.
Traits of his generation.
Yeah, absolutely. My dad, though, I don't know. I mean, my dad was, and you can tell when I'm sitting here talking about it, he was a very special guy. I mean, a very special guy. And I think a lot of that got left behind when he went to the Navy, when he worked hard to get where he was. And, you know, if you think about the South and the potential racism that existed back in the 20s and 30s and 40s and all of that, I think that faded away as the generations moved on. And I think, too, based upon the legal profession that he was in, you know, he was an insurance defense attorney. So he defended insurance companies, but he also looked at the people who were trying to get a little, you know, because they had been done wrong to. And my dad said more than once, you know, in trial, he was a great litigator, and he said more than once in trial, you know, these people deserve something. You know, we're being sued, but these people are right. They deserve something. They may not deserve it from the company that I represent, but they certainly deserve something because they've been wronged. And I think Dad had friends of all income levels, all demographic levels, and everything else when you look back at it. And he was a guy that, I mean, the bigotry and stuff of the South of the probably 30s, 40s, and 50s just didn't seem to translate, you know? It just didn't. But that's my perception of it. You know, what somebody else's perception might be, I don't know. But I just know that looking back on his dad and comparing him to my dad, it was light years different. I will say that for sure.
And in theory, that's the way it's supposed to work,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, absolutely. Each generation. And I hope my kids see that in me, you know, so.
So knowing you, without knowing your family background, it's always been clear that education has been an important part of your life. Tell me about being the son of a lawyer, following in his footsteps scholastically, but also where does this interest in athleticism from a motor racing standpoint start to come in? Because those are two those are two giant branches where you rarely get both colliding in the way that yours has.
I mean, I think there was, you know, and I'm not crying the blues by any stretch of the imagination. I was incredibly fortunate. We, you know, the house that I was born in was the typical 1950s, probably 1,800 square feet, three bedroom, one bath. And there were three kids and our parents in it. And then we moved to a little bit bigger house. His dad became more successful. He stayed with the same law firm for 33 years until he passed away. And then we moved into a much larger house, you know, later. And so I never really wanted for anything. It's funny, I've always said I didn't think I was particularly spoiled until I look back. I mean, we had to, certainly, there were plenty of kids that I knew that got a car when they turned 16 years old. We didn't get a car when we turned 16. You needed to complete 60 hours of college with a decent GPA, and then Dad would get you a car. So, you know, he drove the education side of things because he came from nothing. I mean, he literally walked dirt roads in bare feet and, you know, and went out and picked berries.
How awesome.
You know, and that kind of stuff. He was a small town. He was poor, you know? So he understood what it meant to come along. When I say I'm not crying the blues, there was tremendous pressure. And I think my brother felt it too. You know, what you always heard was, are you going to be an attorney like your dad? Well, how are you going to be an attorney like your dad? You know, I mean, he came from nothing to being this huge success. I guarantee you I can go back to Houston and walk in any law firm there and mention his name and somebody will say, I remember him.
Wow.
I saw a guy in the airport in Houston probably 8 or 10 years ago, and the name of the law firm that he worked for, and you'll recognize this. In the beginning, when I was a little kid, it was Fulbright, Crooker, Freeman, Bates, and Jaworski. It ended up being Fulbright and Jaworski, and I think that's what it is now, either that or people just refer to it as Fulbright, but that was Leon Jaworski, who wow. was the Watergate special prosecutor, who I used to go duck and goose hunting with on Saturday mornings, and I can fully remember how you learned to play the corporate game there as the flight of ducks would come in or geese would come in, and we would all raise up and shoot, and Mr. Jaworski would be pointed in one direction, and we would be pointed in the other, and the ducks and geese would fall, and my dad would go, "Nice shot, Mr. Jaworski," and wow. I'd go, "But Dad," just about the time I got the hand to the side of the head. It's like, "Oh, okay, I get it, I get it. Never outfish the boss," right?
Wow.
So, but anyway, it was, I think there was a lot of pressure, and I my brother became an attorney. My sister went to law school. My cousin's an attorney. And I just looked at it, and I think my dad was a hero to me. He was larger than life, and he was made larger than life by those people around him who viewed him that way, who viewed him as such an amazing man. And I think somewhere inside of me, I thought, I can't compete with that. I need to find my own way, my own thing, because I don't think I could ever measure up to being compared to the age-old line that I heard a million times if I heard it once. Are you going to be an attorney like your dad?
So that's a really interesting point to me. I don't think it's abnormal for sons or daughters to look at their father or mother's profession and have a desire or pressure, as you mentioned, possibly to follow. It sounds like your father was also a large personality.
A huge personality.
And that, to me, is the interesting thing. My father, same way. Huge personality, life of the party.
Yep, lit up a room.
Throw the party and then be the life of the party type. And I picked up on that. I learned some of that. Some of it was natural, some of it wasn't.
Yep.
But I always looked at him with a particular reverie because in his own nature was this presence and command. I didn't necessarily have that naturally, but did feel some pressure to be like that. How about you? Because folks, whether they might not know you, hopefully they'll know you more, a little more when we're done here. You have a great, big, bright personality. It's a lot of fun, but I'm curious, was that nature? Was that learned? How did this develop?
Yeah, I look at my two kids, and I see two very different people. My brother and I are two very different people. My brother and I are much like my two sons, but I think some of it's natural and some of it is learned, just like you said. The sad thing is my father passed away when I was 25. Mm. And,
Something we have in common.
Yeah, I have chills on my arms, my hair standing up on the back of the neck when I say this. But the thing that is kind of emotional to me, I guess, is that I spent 25 years in awe of my dad.
Mm.
And sitting there and listening to how great a man he was and all of this. And he was. But I spent 25 years standing back and admiring. And I wish I had spent 25 years engaging and learning. And when my dad passed away, I mean, I look at it every day now and think, God, I would love to have his opinion. I'd love to have his thought. I'd love to have his guiding hand, you know, and he's not there. And that's, so I kind of got his personality. Some of it was learned because I looked at him and what he did. He was a performer just like I am.
Yeah.
He was a litigator.
Yeah, yeah.
He stood in front of a courtroom and, you know, pleaded his case, so to speak. And so I think I got that from him. I hope I'm as good at what I do as he was at my entertainment than what he was. I don't think so. Mm. Probably just because I hold him in such high reverence, and I'm sure he's looking down on me going, "You idiot, you're better than I ever was." I never saw in him the things that I see in me, and the things that I, you know, it's not the things that you want people to know by any stretch of the imagination, but and I guess we all have it, you know, the nerves and the self-doubt and those times when you get down and you're hard on yourself and, you know, your self-esteem at its highest. I never saw that in him. Probably because I spent 25 years, like I said, you know, looking at it and admiring. I'm sure it was there, but I'd love to compare those notes. But I don't have the opportunity to do that because, man, I don't know about other race car drivers. But to me, I've always said when I drove that on any given day, anybody out there could beat me. But on any given day, I could beat anybody out there. I kind of felt like I wasn't that guy that felt invincible. I was that guy who felt like I had a fair shot on any given day and that I could run at the front. And
that's a pretty amazing pragmatism to have.
So, why?
Because that is not a common trait. That isn't. I was interviewing our friend Juan Montoya very recently and asked him a very succinct question of Senna or Schumacher, meaning which, you know, which camp are you? Because they are very different camps. Normally you get an instant response of one name and then some sort of reverie or explanation why. His response was, are you kidding? He was incredulous. Are you kidding?
Couldn't even believe you asked the question.
And I said, yeah, seriously, Senna. Like, as in, duh. But it wasn't from a passion standpoint. I said, all right, well, tell me, you know, fill me in a little bit more. He said, because I beat the other guy.
Yeah,
like it was.
There was no doubt.
It was one of those things like, well, I handled the other guy, so why would I have any reverie for him? And this is a guy who, at 43, who hasn't raced in Formula One for 13 years, is instantly transported to that hunter-killer mindset of anything other than me beating you is an abnormality. Yep. So a pragmatic view of, I could beat you on any day and I could lose any day, was, we haven't even gotten into how motor racing came into your life yet, but do you think that was just part of your personality that came into motor racing to have that view? Is it something you learned?
Well, you know,
in after learning you could lose or win any day?
I think that's something that my dad was a part of as well. You know, I mean, my dad was one of these guys, and I think part of it, once again, was because of the way that he was raised. My dad was one of these guys who would kind of poke you in the chest, not literally, but figuratively, to try to get you stirred up. You know, he was the parent, and I know it'll sound bad. You know, I played baseball when I was a kid, and he would say, you know, you can't break an egg with that pitch. Come on, you need to, I've seen a better swing on a gate, you know, that kind of stuff. And his thought was, I believe, and the only thing I have to go on is the way I imagine it as him growing up. I imagine his dad saying to him when they moved to Houston, and dad said, I'm going to go to the Navy. His dad said, yeah, fine, go be a Navy man. And then when he came home and he said, I'm going to go to college. Well, nobody in the family had gone to college. Why are you going to go to college? You can't do that. And dad saying, oh, yeah, I can. Okay. And then when he got out of college, he said, hey, I'm going to be an attorney. And his dad said, you can't do that. You know, and so I think in my dad's mind, the whole you can't, to kind of poke you in the chest and get you fired up and get you to charge and dig a little bit deeper and try to find that little bit. But I also think you have to be careful about that because everybody responds to it differently. Some people, when you say you can't often enough, believe that they can't, especially if it's coming from somebody that they admire.
Yeah, I'd start balling fists.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when it's somebody that, And I know this sounds bad. I mean, like I said, my dad is still a hero to me. But I think at times, my dad got me to believe that I couldn't. That's not what he wanted.
Yeah.
What he wanted was to stir you up and make you a little bit deeper. And it was one of those things that I think eventually, and it kind of leads to the racing thing. You know, my parents didn't know that I was racing when I started racing. They had no idea.
Wow.
I raced for almost 2 years before they knew that I was racing. Oop. Yes, ma'am. No, thank you. That kind of just snuck in. They had no idea that I was racing. And one of the great reasons, and one of the reasons I didn't want him to know, is because I didn't want him to tell me that I couldn't.
Jesus.
And
we're going deep early. I love this.
I proved to myself that I could before they found out. And so at that point in time, I had kind of the best of both worlds. You know, I had the understanding that I could, but I also knew that I was human. And I just like I knew that Mickey Mantle struck out, I also knew that Mickey Mantle hit home runs. And that it's, I think to some extent, at some point in time, pride and confidence can be, they can be unrealistic. You know, and when you look at, it's kind of like talking to young drivers about winning races or winning championships. I mean, sure, you'd love to go out and win every race and win the championship. But if you want to win the championship, you also have to be realistic and understand that mechanical problems come along. Occasionally you have a bad day. Occasionally somebody has a good day. And what you really need to do is win in a car that's capable of winning, finish third in a third place car. And if you finish second in a third place car, well, you had a great day. You know, and you go out and you play the game. And hopefully in the end, you win. But, yeah, you've got the confidence that you can do it. But you know that the playing field is also incredibly level, especially the higher up the ladder you go, because the talent just gets deeper and deeper and deeper.
So where does motor racing, interest in cars, where does that, what age, and where does it start to filter into your life?
But you know, back in the olden days when I was growing up, I mean, we had a little farm outside of Houston. And, you know, you drove from an early age. I probably started driving a car when I was 10 years old. You know, you'd go out to the farm and you'd get off the freeway and you'd get on the back road and you'd sit in your dad's lap. Of course, you know, nobody's wearing a seatbelt or anything else, but, you know, you sat in your dad's lap and you couldn't reach the pedals, but you could steer. And so you would steer to the farm, you know, and a year or two later, well, my legs never got particularly long, you know that, but, you know, you get a little older and then your dad or your grandpa would move the seat back and you would sit between their legs and you could reach the pedals and
now
steer.
Now I know why you sit in Dorsey's lap.
That's exactly
out.
Why we do that on the way out here. But, you know, so you drove and then, you know, by the time you were 13, you'd get to the farm and you'd say, hey, can I take the car and go drive around out in the pasture? Or eventually it was, hey, can I take the car down the road? And we used to drive when we were probably 13 or 14 years old. The road layout was kind of interesting. But, you know, you could go 2 miles in one direction and 2 miles in the other. So we would just make these 4 mile sweeps back and forth with the farm as kind of the middle of that sweep. And we'd drive half an hour at a time, just back and forth, back and forth. So we drove. And then, you know, the yard cart came in. And, you know, so we bought a little go-kart. My dad found a go-kart that somebody had, and they said, oh, this would be great at your farm. Well, it was, but it wasn't a yard cart. It wasn't a field cart. It didn't have knobby tires. It had slicks on it, you know, and a 5-horsepower motor on grass. So it was like
it was like
a slick track. It was fantastic, and it was just dumb luck. I mean, he just knew somebody who had it and bought it for $100 or whatever, and it lived at the farm, and, you know, you just drove it, but you slid everywhere. And then eventually, you know, we had the big, it was a Yazoo lawnmower. We had the tractor with the brush hog on the back, and then we had the mower. And we'd mow the pasture with the brush hog and get that cut down. And then I'd go, hey, I can mow a racetrack with the big mower. So I'd go and mow a racetrack. And then and I finally got a helmet. I finally got him to buy me a helmet at the Army Surplus store. And I didn't want a helmet because I was afraid of falling out of the go-kart or I thought I was going to hit my head. Wanted a helmet
so
with
you
a.
You had like a World War II Army helmet?
No,
what are we
I had
about?
Like an. Literally the Easy Rider helmet. It was a red, white, and blue flag helmet,
yes.
Just like Peter Fonda had an Easy Rider. Except I had, you know, the snap on plastic bubble face shield. And you know why I wanted that?
Oh, why?
Not because I thought it looked cool, because we had cows.
Oh, Jesus.
And so you'd end up with all these fresh cow patties on the racetrack that you cut, and you'd pick it up with the front tire and it'd throw it right in your face. So I wanted a helmet with a visor or a shield on it so I didn't have to eat cow patties.
Coming out of turn three, shitty two. Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, you'd have cow shit everywhere on your racetrack, and so I wanted a helmet. And then, you know, once you got your helmet, then you felt really racy, and, you know, it was kind of off you go. Don't forget, I grew up in Houston, and by now I lived on the west side, and there was some guy named AJ, somebody who lived
Anthony
out there
Joseph
as well.
Something or other.
Whose kids actually went to the same high school that I went to, but a few years behind me. So, you know, and I started, you know, probably 14, 13, 14 or whatever, had the go-kart, had the helmet now, so it was very cool, and started watching the Indy 500, you know, and paying attention to that, and I never thought I would drive a race car, And then when I was a senior in high school, I met a guy by the name of Bobby Martin. And Bobby was in my grade, and we shared one thing in common. We dated the same girl for a while.
Did she know this?
Yeah, she knew that. And Bobby was trying to keep me from being killed by the guy that was dating this girl at the time. So he came to me and said, you need to be careful. But anyway, Bobby and I became great friends and still one of my dearest friends to this day. But his dad raced in the SCCA.
Mm.
He had a little E-Production MG.
Wow.
And then he, I think we would
go. 97 horsepower of Ferrari.
Yeah, yeah. So then we went. So I started going to the races in the summertime with Bobby, and we would follow his dad to the races and, you know, go in the motorhome and spend the weekend, quote, crewing the car. We didn't know him. Didn't know anything about anything, but, you know, it was good. And I just thought, you know, the bug was firmly implanted. The stent was firmly implanted in my arm. And I just thought, hey, this is cool. I'm going to go to college. When I'm making 150, 250 grand a year when I graduate, I'm going to buy a race car and go racing. And then my sophomore year was when I'm making $75,000 a year, I'm going to go racing. And my junior year, it was when I'm making $30,000 a year. By the time I finally graduated, 6.5 years later, I thought, if I just have a job, you know, I would like to go racing maybe.
If I put a roll cage on a shopping cart, I
exactly.
Might
you know, it's funny how the number kept going down, down, down the longer I was there. But, you know, I just thought it just was cool. You know, the whole idea of driving, the whole idea of race car stuff, He sold his MG and bought a Huffacker-prepared MGB.
Wow.
I think in 1978, I think. And so it was like, I just thought it was the coolest thing. The SCCA stuff just seemed to be the coolest thing in the world. And literally, I just thought, when I graduate from college and I get a job, I'll get settled in and I want to do a little race car thing. And it was one of those deals where went off to college. Was going to be a veterinarian. I was a biology major for 2.5 years. I know. Where did that come from, right?
Your parents are signing off on a veterinarian son?
Yep.
Or,
yeah. Okay. They thought that would be great. I mean,
in that area, that wouldn't be, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we grew up with horses and cows out at the farm. We had dogs. We hunted a lot, which people still can't understand that I would kill animals, but
Andy
I want to
Lally,
take care of them.
Sure,
yeah. Andy Lally loves me.
Yes.
He and Spencer, I made the mistake one year. Spencer and I were talking on the phone, and it was November, and I had completely forgotten about Andy and Spencer's stance on all this stuff. And I just said, well, yep. Yeah, you know, Spencer's like, yeah, I got to go. I said, me too. Got to go sit in a tree, see if I can kill Bambi this afternoon. And there was just silence on the other end of the phone. And I thought, was it something I said? And then I realized, you know what? Yes, it was something that I said. So
anyway.
I was always interested in math and science and biology stuff and loved animals. And to this day, I kind of look back at times and go, you know, I should have been a veterinarian. I should have gone ahead and done my thing. But I also realized a couple of years into it that it was harder to get into vet school than med school. So I thought two things. One, if I ever get sick, I'll go see my vet because he's probably smarter than my doctor. And two, I don't want to end up with a biology degree and not have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
So I switched my major. And quite honestly, it's funny. I switched my major and was completely lost. I'm one of these people who has to know where we're going. You know, if my wife... we could get in a car in Columbus, Ohio, where we live, and somebody would go, why don't you guys go west? And she would go, oh, I love going west. But yeah, let's go west. And I'd go, okay, but hang on. Where are we going? What do you mean west? How far west? I mean, how far west are we going? Because I need to plan this, right?
Yes.
You know, I need to plan this. And she'd go, I don't know. Let's go to the west coast. And I'd go, well, hang on. Are we talking Washington, Oregon? Are we talking California? Northern California, Southern California? Because it'll be a different highway system that I take on the way out there. I need to know where we're going. So I'm a planner. And she is not. And when I changed my plan from being a biology major, I really kind of sat lost for about a year in school. My grades went to hell in a handbasket and got confused, thought I wanted to be a musician for a little while. I played my guitar at a bar there in Waco, Texas, where I went to Baylor, which I know Baylor's just thrilled to, with some of the things I've done in my life. But anyway, and then, you know, I had always followed racing, thought I might want to be a pilot. And talked to my dad about,
I want to be an astronaut.
You know, I know
I
it was, you know,
Joe.
I talked to my dad about becoming a pilot, and he said, well, before you quit college, because I said, I think I might want to go to the American Airlines Academy in Dallas-Fort Worth. He said, before you do that, Why don't you start flying? You know, let's give you some flying lessons out at the airport. See if you even want to do that, because you just have this romantic view of it right now.
I'm keep you alive. So
started flying a little bit, which I still do to this day. But I was on my way back from a rare weekend flight lesson there at the airport in Waco. And right there beside the airport sits, to this day, the Heart of Texas Kart Club.
Heart of Texas Kart Club. That is a beautiful
name. I was driving by, and it was a Saturday. And, I mean, I'd driven by lots of times and just really had never paid it any mind. But since it was a Saturday, there were a bunch of trucks and trailers there. And when I say trucks and trailers, it's not like half of the kart races that you go to today. I mean, like a pickup truck with a 10-foot box trailer behind it, not like an 18-wheeler. But and I was like, oh, you know what? I'm a huge race fan. I would sit on Sunday mornings and watch Formula One races and stuff like that. So I was still very much a race fan. And I thought, you know, all these Formula One drivers got started driving go-karts. I should stop and watch. And I can remember hearing about karts. So I pull in, climb up in the grandstands, and I hear this, you know, this cart comes out around the track, and then another one fires up. And I'm sitting there going, holy crap. This is insane.
These guys
are up on two wheels, and they are wicked fast, and you could die doing this. I've got to have one. And then it became, how am I going to buy a go-kart? And I got a job, which my parents didn't know that I had.
Doing what?
Taking pictures at sorority and fraternity parties. I was the guy that was walking around taking pictures.
So you're getting paid for something you'd been doing for free earlier.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I got paid for that, and I used that money to buy a go-kart. Met one of the local kart dealers, and a guy who was a part supplier, and bought his son's used go-kart and a Yamaha KT100 engine, and I could put the go-kart in the back of my Toyota Celica, because I had a Celica hatchback, and I could fold the rear seats down and put the cart in the back of the Celica, and I drove all over the state of Texas for a year and a half racing my go-kart. I could put the extra set of wheels in the seat, my little Sears toolbox in between the left rear wheel and the left front wheel, and a gas can in the back, and that's all I needed, and I drove around the state of Texas racing go-karts. And so that's how I got started.
That sounds
racing.
Like the most awesome
and my parents didn't
fun thing. I'm serious.
It was fantastic. I mean, look, to this day, and I'm sure other guys will tell you the same thing, to this day, some of the most fun I ever had in racing was racing at the kart club on a Saturday night and then going and drinking beer and eating pizza at the Pizza Hut, you know, and just having fun. SCCA races at Chenault Field in Lake Charles, Louisiana, on Saturday nights, you'd have crawfish boil and, you know, and just sit around and eating crawfish out of a 55-gallon drum boiled with a bunch of corn and potatoes and just fun racing. And then, of course, you know, the further up the ladder you went, the more work it became. Not that that's a sob story by any stretch of the imagination, but to your point, the kart racing was a ball. Absolute ball.
So in this local Heart of Texas karting experience, driving around Texas karting, are there benchmarks? This is the guy.
Yeah,
this
sure.
This person is going places where you could then not only measure yourself, but was there a point at that level at least where the light bulb went off for you where you said, this could be more than just weekend fun?
Well, it goes off for everybody the first time you win something, right? It doesn't matter whether it's a t-ball game, you're going to be the next whomever, or a local kart race. And look, there, and I've said this since I was fortunate enough to start doing my professional racing stuff, there's so much talent out there. There's so many people that have the ability to mash the pedal, turn the wheel, think clearly, and all of that. But you know as well as I do that money makes the wheels go round, literally and figuratively. And it's a business. You know, motorsports is a business, and if you can't grasp the business side of it and help either represent a product or help that team owner, or whatever, continue to reach their business goals, it's hard to be a professional race car driver. You've got to be the best of the best if you're going to get paid on your talent alone, and you got to be really good and pretty marketing savvy to help represent, you know, below that. And then beyond that, you got to be somebody that just has money to bring, you know, to go racing. And sometimes the guy that has money to bring is just as good as some of the other guys. He's just never had the opportunity to do it. So I look at some of the guys that I raced with. I can think of, I say kids. I mean, obviously this was 1980 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're not kids anymore. But at the time, who were 13, 14 years old, that you just looked at and went, whoa, oh my. You know, they'd go run the IKF Nationals, you know, the national championships, and win or finish second or third. And you're like, these kids are really, really, really good. But for one reason or another, the next avenue was never going to be there, whether that was financially, whether that was connections and just knowing people that could take you to the next level or give you an opportunity at the next level. So from that standpoint, yeah, there are benchmarks everywhere. There are benchmarks. My kids are both big baseball players. There are benchmarks on every T-ball field, little league field, high school field that you want to measure and go against and be better than. Some of those get the opportunity to move on and some don't. But yeah, but there were guys that you wanted to beat. You know, the local hot shoe, the state hot shoe, somebody that you'd known had gone to the Nationals and won a national championship or finished on the podium at the national championships. You wanted to beat that guy because you felt like if you did, then you were that good.
Sure.
You know, and you could, if you just had the opportunity, you could go and win a national championship. But, you know, my parents would find out if I had to go to the Nationals. I would need more gas money, right? It's a lot of pictures
so
to take.
Tell me about the transition from karting into where we start to hear the name Brian Till as a young open wheeler doing things. Not, you know, we've got some Atlantic races to do. We've got a lot of things that we still need to do. But tell me about that transition, because to your point, that involves money.
Yep.
And if you're not working 70 hours a week as a lawyer, racking in a bunch of dough to pay for that, you've got to find someone else to help do that.
Absolutely.
Tell me about teams you're talking to and how you make that jump.
So, it's funny because the karting stuff came along, and my parents found out when I graduated is pretty much how it turned out. But my best friend's dad, who raced in the SCCA, Don Martin, Mr. Martin said, hey, you know, you and Bobby have – helped me so much over the years, and I know that you're such a huge race fan. If your parents will send you to a 3-day racing school for graduation present from college, I'll let you use my race car to do an SCCA school, and then you can run the regional race the next day and get your regional license. And I thought, this is the coolest thing in the world. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world because at the time he had a Lola Sports 2000. And I thought, I get to go take a driver's school in a Sports 2000. Oh, my God, this is going to be so incredibly cool. And he was talking about buying a new one. And I thought, this is going to be awesome. So my parents sent me to Jim Russell for graduation. I went and did the school, and I was hooked. You know, there was a guy in the Southwest Division of the SCCA when I was in high school and early in college that had this beautiful, beautiful black Crosley Formula Ford with gold leaf numbers on it, 31. And I just thought, Formula Ford, oh, my God. That's you know, all I ever wanted to drive was a Formula Ford.
If you don't have a soft spot for Formula Fords, you are a member of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, there's something wrong.
That's all
yeah.
I'm saying.
So went and did my driver's school in a Formula Ford. Mark Wallachuk was my instructor.
Mark Wallachuk.
Yeah. Was my instructor at Riverside, California, and did that. It took my driver's school and Mr. Martin's brand new car that he bought, which I was a little disappointed with because I thought he was going to buy a brand new Sports 2000. But in 1985, this brand new class came out called Sports Renault. So the Sports 2000 went away. And it was replaced with a Sports Renault. Yes, I know.
You could stack three of those together, so, and they still wouldn't be as fast.
But,
as a...
So I did the school in Lake Charles, Louisiana. I did the regional race the next day, and I can't remember if I won the race or finished second. But it was just kind of literally off to the races. So Mr. Martin said, hey, you did pretty good. You know, if you want, we can go to these races. And at the time, SCCA was typically about regional race on Saturday, national race on Sunday. So we would go to the races, and I would run the regional race, and he would run the national race because I just had a regional license.
Sure.
So he said, you know, you've got your provisional. You're doing pretty well. You'll probably get your regional here, run two or three races, you'll get your regional license. So just started doing that. Meanwhile, I was looking for a job. And the job market in 1985 in Houston was not particularly good. So we got three or four races into the thing, into the season, and he said, you know, I don't think I want to do this anymore. I think I'm going to sell the car. And I was devastated.
I bet.
Devastated, because we were doing really well. And one of the guys I got to race with was a guy named Jim Averett. I've become, nice. You know, obviously good friends with, who's steward in SECA and still know to this day. It was so fun to catch up with him later. But anyway, my dad said, look, they gave me my national license after three races. He said, look, you've got an opportunity to go to the runoffs. And you may never have this opportunity again, because you, my son, need a job. And once you start working, you may not ever, A, make the money, or B, get the time off. So I'll tell you what. If you'll stay home, do the things I want you to do around the house, I'll take care of the racing. We'll see if we can find somebody to help buy the car, which he did. He had a client, a guy by the name of Red Adair, who was the oil well firefighting guy. So Red ponied up some money, and we bought the car and trailer from Don and continued to run it for the rest of the summer. And I remember it to this day. So I had a chance to go to the runoffs, and my dad was pulling out of the driveway to go to the hunting lease in South Texas on September 20th. Was it the 20th, or did he leave on the 21st? Can't remember, but we stopped. And he stopped going out, and I stopped coming in. So, you know, we're door to door, and he said, are you sure you don't want to go? The birds are supposed to be flying, you know, really well. Your sister and her husband are going. I said, no, I need to stay here and work on the car, get it ready for the runoffs, maybe next weekend. So he pulled out. I pulled in the driveway, and by Saturday afternoon, he was dead. He had a heart attack down at the hunting lease. And so he pulled out that day, and I never saw him again. And that was 2 weeks before the runoffs. And my mom said, you know, he would have wanted you to go. And so go ahead and go. So I went, and we did okay. I raced against this guy named Dorsey Schrader. I don't know who the heck
never
he
heard.
Is. But did okay in the pro race runoffs and stuff. I can't remember where I finished, but I did better than I thought I would do, which was probably a bad thing because that got me more hooked.
Yes.
And then in the runoffs, I had a flat right rear with like two laps to go, and I drove around for 2.5 laps on a flat right rear Goodyear on my sports Renault, which came apart and shredded the bodywork like a hacksaw. And Mr. Martin said, what the hell are you, what are you doing? And I said, I came to the runoffs and I was going to finish and I was going to see the checkered flag, you know? And so I did. And Patsy Henry, who was chief steward, called me up at the time to the tower. And I thought, oh my God, I got to go see the steward, which is funny considering I'm a world challenge steward.
Yes.
But we talked about that, and I promised I would never go drive around on a flat tire and spread debris all around the racetrack ever again. And I went home after the runoffs, and my dad wasn't there, you know, and I had a race car and a trailer and a Suburban, and I thought, I think I can do this. And I sat down and I talked to my mom, and I said, I think I can do this, and I want to look at some avenues. And so sold the trailer. And when I say trailer, it was a 16-foot flatbed trailer with a sports Renault parked on top of it. Sold the car, the trailer, and the Suburban, and used that money. And, you know, as luck would have it, Skip Barber was starting the Barbersab Pro Series in 1986. And I ran two SCCA races in 1986 and then sold all that and dropped the money to Skip Barber. And I'm the answer to a very bizarre trivia question. I won the very first ever Barbersab Pro Race in June of 1986 at the Meadowlands. And
in an Irish Mondial chassis.
Yes, exactly. That was the step that moved me forward. That was the step of, you know what, I can do this. Robbie Unser was running, Eric Keltz, Willie Lewis, you know, guys that were good SCCA racers and stuff. And Willie obviously had won in just about anything that he had ever driven in. And I thought, you know, I could do this. And it was funny. I was just talking about prize money with somebody today. And I said, you know, I was able to run the entire 1986 season on prize money. You know, prize money kept us going. I would win races or finish on the podium. And it was what catapulted you to the next round. And that really got it going. And I finished second in the championship that year, barely missed out on the championship, and Skip approached and said, hey, you know, do you want to instruct for the school? And that's where I met Dorsey for the second time. And he and I have been close friends since then. For 30 years, we've known each other because we both went and became Skip Barber instructors. And that really kind of sent me off on the road to meeting the people that I needed to meet to get me to the next level.
So the Barber Sob series, for those who weren't familiar with it, would have been something in the range of between USF 2000 and Pro Mazda today.
Yeah.
Turbocharged 2-liter engines, my dad being a Saab specialist. That was a series that we always loved. There was a lot of talent that made a stop or proved that they were deserving of going on.
Yeah.
By going through Barber Sob. Maybe winding the clock forward a little bit, but tell me about first of all, how did the SASAPA Records relationship come together? Because of the coming up next in the Brian Till story, we have some pretty awesome Atlantic stuff, beautiful Swift DB4 and other great stuff. But let's talk a little bit about the Atlantic stuff. And to be honest, we are probably going to have to hit the pause button here. And I always knew we were going to have a part 2 or part 3 because we have your IndyCar career, a little bit of sports cars.
My career wasn't that long. I don't know why. I talk a lot.
I know. But so as someone who grew up working on Formula Fords, Formula Atlantics, loving them, still a huge passion of mine, listening to a Cosworth BDA or when the Toyota Atlantic engines came in, 1.6-liter four-cylinder, listening to a proper Atlantic car wound up screaming through, whether it's a Turn 10 at Sears Point, somewhere at Elkhart Lake. Tell me about the move from, say, a Barber Sob to Formula Atlantic at that time where, look, kids, we love today's Indy Lights cars and other things. If I had a choice of buying one, although I couldn't fit a DB4 or something similar, my goodness. But those were visceral cars.
Just
tell me about that jump, though. Did Barber Sob get you all the way there?
No, but you see, because the thing that was interesting is, I ended up teaching for Skip Barber for a couple of years, and I was quitting. I was stepping out of the sport. In 1988, I was done. Done.
Wow.
I said, I've given a couple of years to this. It's not going anywhere. I need to get a real job before I get to be too old, you know? And so I was headed back to the workforce. And I met a guy named Bob Liebert from Columbus, Ohio, at the last Skip Barber school I ever did at Road America in 1988. And he goes, what are you doing next year? I've got some business plans. I'd like to be involved in motorsports. He did a 7-day program, did a 3-day school, car control clinic, a lapping day, and then a race weekend. And I said, I'm not doing anything. I'm going back to Houston. I'm getting a job. I'm done. He goes, no, let's talk. And for anybody who's ever been an instructor at any racing school in the world, they've heard that
this
lie.
But it's the dream.
Yeah,
but
it never works.
I've got a trillion-dollar company,
exactly.
And you're my guy.
So, and Bob, he's a great guy. I mean, he's a huge heart, probably one of the biggest-hearted guys that I know. And I said, yeah, fine. Yeah, give me a call, whatever. And by the time I got home from Houston on Monday afternoon, I had a message on the answering machine. He said, I want to send the plane down to pick you up and want to fly you up and let's talk about this. And quite honestly, I went to Columbus and we talked and he said, this is what I'm thinking about doing. I'm getting involved with this record company and want to use motorsports to help promote it. He already knew John Fergus and John was involved already.
The great John Fergus.
Yeah. And he said, I want to bring you involved as well. And I want to do the Barber Sob series next year with you in a car. And I said, thank you, but no, thank you. And something I never thought I would say. And it wasn't a bargaining chip, but I had been there and done that.
Wow.
And I finished second and I didn't want to do it again because there was a lot of talent and you needed to win.
Yep.
You know, I needed to win. I finished second. I needed to win. Finishing third did me no good. And and I went home. I told him no. And I went home.
Wow.
And started looking for a job. And like a week later, he called me back and said, no, I want you to come back up here. Let's talk about it again. So we went back up and he said, all right, let's talk longer term. What if we do this, this, and this? You know, and I'm like, okay, well, now there's a future. You know, I see three more steps. And those are steps that I would have never gotten to, and I may hate myself forever if I don't take those steps. So I said yes, and we ran Barber Saab again in 1989. The car had slicks on it. I'd still never driven a race car with slicks on it.
Wow.
So the car had slicks on it, and it was not particularly good. It was designed for shaved street radials. I hadn't driven slicks. It was a handful. Didn't do as well as I thought I was going to. Didn't win. I think I finished fifth in the championship or something like that. But Bob was a man that was true to his word, and we moved from Barber Saab in 89 to the Atlantic Series. And motorsports is not about the car that you drive. It's not about the talent that you have. It's about the people that are around you. And when I moved to the Atlantic Series in 1990, there's a guy who had been an instructor at Skip Barber, Super V champion by the name of Peter Kuhn, who
yes.
was a good friend of mine and came on as my driver coach in 1989. And when we decided to do the Atlantic stuff in 90, he said, I know a guy that you need to have run the car, a guy by the name of Steve Cole. So all of a sudden,
we're setting up the stage
now
here.
We're setting the stage, because all of a sudden, it's like I said, it's not just about the driver, it's the people that are around. And all of a sudden, I ended up with Steve Cole, Peter Kuhn, Gerald Tyler, Grant Weaver, you know, and you start naming off people that I can walk around and look at the
yes.
guys on these little teams that have engineered some of the best programs in road racing and open wheel racing over the last couple of decades. And we all learn together, and we all won together, and we all move forward together. And obviously at some point in time, we all split our separate ways, but it was an awesome time to be a race car driver and to have some of the best talent that still exists in motorsports today be around you and take those steps together out into this future. It was awesome.
So tell me about your first experience driving an Atlantic car. What was that like from a
I don't know what heroin's
standpoint.
Like. But it still to this day is probably one of the most fun cars I've ever driven. You said it's just a visceral experience. It sounded good. It stopped well. It cornered well. It had okay power. There's something about it. It's, and like I said, to this day, it's some of my favorite experiences in motorsports surrounded that car. And if I could get it back, I know I couldn't get the talent back, but if I could get the car back, I would love to spend a day in a DB4 Atlantic car the way they were when we ran them. I would love to have that opportunity again.
So set the stage for us on what that mid to late 80s, even early 90s, Atlantic scene was like, because we didn't have a single unified.
Nope. East-West.
We had East and West, separate championships. There was, for a few years there, a very cool let's meet up and find out
yep.
who's the best. Who are you racing against? Who are the badasses that you were having to prove yourself against? Because you came out of this and did make it into IndyCar.
Yep.
So clearly, again, for those who might know Brian Till, the broadcaster, might not realize that, no, you were doing some damn impressive things coming up that open wheel ladder, too.
Well, I mean, you look at East-West, and on the West, Mark Dismore is the guy who dominated that. I ended up winning the East. But in the East, Reynard had come over with a brand-new car,
yep.
Freddie Rimrev, and the craziest, fastest French-Canadian at the time, probably still in the world to this day as far as the crazy side of things, was Claude Bourbonnais.
Yep.
And, oh, my God, the guy was afraid of absolutely nothing. And,
Jocko Cunningham,
yeah, just wickedly fast. Jocko Cunningham, who was a previous series champion, was there.
EJ Lenzi, yep. I think. Peter Fossetta.
So, yeah, so there was good talent in the East, and there was, there was Dismore in the West, Jovi Marcello.
Vassar
from time to time. So it was good, and it's good that we weren't all together, because I probably would have never won the championship if we'd been all together.
Today's race.
You know, but it was a great learning opportunity. And like I said, it's the people that you're around. What the Atlantic car did for me was it gave me a much more high-tech understanding of motorsports. Mm. You know, it was the first time I had worked with an engineer. It was first time I worked with proper crew chiefs. It's the first time that I had ever used data acquisition. It was really the first time that I had a driver coach who could work with me in depth, not only in just driving the car, but on how to set it up. We built this team that was tiny but mighty. I mean, it was Steve owned the shop in Winchester, Virginia. Cole Performance was the name of it at the time. Grant worked for him. His nephew Travis worked for him. And that was it. There were three full-time guys in the shop. Gerald came in and engineered on the weekends, and obviously they worked back and forth. And it's so funny. I mean, this is how dedicated Steve was to making the thing work, and how dedicated Steve is to this day to motorsports. At the time, in 1990, we had an onboard camera. So we had the onboard camera for most of the races. And so the guys decided that Steve should be able to watch the onboard video. So they bought him a VHS tape player because he didn't own one in 1990.
Wow.
And then Steve on his own decided that if he was going to watch the video, that he should probably should watch it in color because he didn't own a color television in 1990. He was so dedicated to building his shop and investing in the shop, much to his dear wife Claudia's chagrin, I'm sure, that he did without those things. The guys got paid more money than he did because he's passionate about motorsports, and he still is to this day. I think through the Cadillac program that ran in World Challenge over the last several years, you know, it's kind of hard to go head-to-head with one of your dear friends, but there were several times we didn't see eye to eye on decisions that the stewards made, and he with the Cadillac program. But, you know, it was just such a massive learning experience. It was awesome. And then you talk about how do you measure yourself. You know, Vicki O'Connor came up with a great idea to do the East-West Shootout at Road America. And you think about the characters that were involved with that. You know who interviewed me on the grid?
Mm.
Calvin Fish. That's what I think about. You know, all the guys that I worked with, Steve Shelton and Calvin Fish were doing the television stuff. You know,
Steve
and it was
Shelton.
Like, what a great time. You know, and I look back over my involvement in racing, and there are times where I think, man, I should have just been a veterinarian. And then I look back and I go, but think about all the characters that I've seen and worked with. But anyway, you know, you go to the runoffs or to the East-West Shootout. Vassar won it. I finished second. Bourbonnais flew in. He was trying to do F3000 at the time.
Yes.
Flew in on Saturday night. Got the rear wing. He started dead last. And I would just keep an eye on him coming up through the field. I'm like, shit. That Red Reynard is another position up. SOB is going to do well here. You know, I got to keep him back there. And he ended up with a damaged rear wing and was just hanging off the car. And I'm watching him come through the kink sideways. You know, it was easily flat in an Atlantic car, and he was easily flat too, but with a rear wing hanging off the car. And I'm on the radio going, you know, this is not safe. They should really bring him in, which they eventually did. But Jimmy won, and I finished second. And, you know, it was just – we measured ourselves all year long, and we just kind of kept track with how were we doing, not how was I doing, how were we doing as a team. And, you know, it got to the end of this – or halfway through the season, it was obvious that we were going to have a shot at the championship. And if you had told me that at the beginning of the year, the goal would have been finish in the top three in the championship, win the championship in 91, 92 maybe move along or whatever. And, you know, we ended up taking the rookie of the year stuff and winning the championship, and it was just wasn't a feather in my cap. It was a feather in everybody's cap. I think there was a lot of looking in the mirror at the end of the season going, holy crap,
we
can do that.
We can
you know
this
whether
trophy?
That was whether that was Steve and the affirmation it gave to him as being able to run a championship winning pro level program out of his little shop in Winchester,
That's
Virginia.
So awesome.
Or Gerald Tyler, his ability to say, I am a race engineer.
Yes.
You know, I am a race engineer. And Grant and Travis, the guys saying, hey, we can put a car together that'll go win. All these details that Steve makes us pay attention to, they're valid, you know? And
well, let's close on this because I think it'd be a fun thing to pick up on when we start part two, which might be the Roar or something next year, I'm not sure. But so this awesome Cole Performance team that's been assembled. You win the Eastern Atlantic Championship. How does graduation to IndyCar unfold for you? Because you're, for those who want to look up Brian Till's Wikipedia page, you have a really cool and diverse, it isn't a long IndyCar career, but you have a pretty cool, diverse number of entrants you drove for, and you were one of very few human beings to pilot the True Sports chassis.
Which was a great chassis.
But tell me about the process of drivers who aren't blessed with trillions of dollars. There was no $1 million.
No, there was no prize money at the end of it.
You're gonna get the Indy 5. There was none of that then. The process. I always love hearing about the process of. So you showed immense talent on the ladder, but how the heck did you get to IndyCar? What were the discussions like? How did that happen financially?
I think, you know, a lot of that had to do with Peter Kuhn and Bob Liebert. You know, it was, I go back to Bob, you know, just had a passion for the sport and still is a huge racing fan. And he looked at it and said, we just won a championship. John Fergus won a championship. John Fergus won the Pro Sports 2000 championship in 90. I won the Atlantic championship in 90. And so Bob's looking at it going, this is cool. The record company was doing okay. So there was further business reasons to carry that forward. We did Indy Lights in 91, and it was a further affirmation that the team could move on, you know. But I really think it was Peter that, you know, we ran Indy Lights in 91, won a race, finished in the top five in the championship, barely missed out on Rookie of the Year to Frank Freon.
Because
I crashed in the rain at the Meadowlands and sustained a concussion, and they wouldn't let me start the race the next day. And I said, please just let me take the green flag and I will park. I promise. No. And if I had, I would have won Rookie of the Year. And that would have been even better because it would have been Rookie of the Year in Atlantic, Rookie of the Year in Indy Lights, and it would have further added to my resume. But I think Bob looked at that and said, we are on a roll. And his loyalty bred loyalty in all of us. You know, I think everybody had opportunities at that point in time to look elsewhere and do other things. But we went and had lunch with Steve Horn one day there, because I was living in Columbus, and that's where Bob was, and that's where I still am. It's where Bob still is.
Yet another great.
Went and had...
It's Romain Dumas, it's Mr. boys Dumas. And girls.
I think Peter Kuhn went to Bob and said, what are we doing next? Mm. And Bob said, well, I don't know. And you know, there was talk about trying to find a ride somewhere, this, that, and the other. And I had begun to think, you know, maybe I need to go look at sports car stuff and all of that. And Bob and I went and had lunch with Steve Horn one day, and he said, you know, we're going to the Chevy A next year. We'll lease you the 91 chassis with the Judd in it, and we'll supply the parts and all of that if you guys want to run it. So Cole Performance went from running their first real pro series with Terry Marshall in the Atlantic Series in 1989 to winning the championship in 90 to running an Indy Lights car in 91 and an Indy car in 92. And so for
amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing for all of us, and it was because of Bob's passion to the sport and his passion for the people that he had hired that stepped up. Every task that was thrown in front of them, they answered. Whether that was me driving, Steve running the program, Grant, Gerald, Travis, Mike LaFontaine, who came in and worked on the car at one point in time along the way, and the other guys, we all answered the bell, and it became infectious. And that's really kind of what brought us up through the IndyCar stuff, or to the IndyCar stuff.
Speaking of infectious, Brian Till, boys and girls. So we're going to hit the pause here because you are going to have to get some lunch and go do some work. We're here in Monterey for what I'm calling Petit Blanc Pain for the California 8-Hour, also the World Challenge Touring Car season finale. But let's hit the pause button here, and hopefully it's sad that it's only about 2 months from now, it feels like. We're going to be back racing again, but once we get to Daytona, let's pick this back up and start off on a part two of Brian Till getting into IndyCar.
And then also your career that I love and I think many people enjoy of your role as a broadcaster, pit reporter, bon vivant, and otherwise, because that's cool too. And I will, I try not to be too geeky here, but although I am 46, I am very, very new to your world, your current profession, but I've always looked at you and the way that you have conducted yourself, whether it's in the booth or on pit lane, there's a sense of joy, completeness, and character that you bring to what you do that I think is very unique. So that's something I really do want to explore, because I will freely admit that I try and steal and learn as much as I can from you. So
normally I have to pay for therapy like this.
It's all good. So all the garbage that I do, I'll just kind of say, it's Till's fault.
It's always my fault.
Well, thank you, brother.
No, thank you, Marshall.
Should I have been recording, by the way?
You should have hit record.
And that was our man, Brian Till. I do love that guy. He is so darn good at what he does. He makes broadcasting a motor race sound and look incredibly easy. And it isn't. Not by any stretch. And that's both the brilliance and the frustration. And I look at someone like Brian and realize, man, I wish it came that easy to everyone, especially me, because it doesn't. So look forward to finding some time here soon, I hope, in the coming months. And I won't wait that much longer after we record it to put it up, but to get a part two going, delve further into his IndyCar career and also into his broadcast career. Thanks again to Cooper Tires for their ongoing support of our podcast, and to the Justice Brothers for jumping in here for the month of July. And we look forward to putting up some more episodes here as we head into the end of July and get into a busy stretch in August. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast presented by Cooper Tires. Thanks so much for listening.